Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Two guests today. First, very soon, Adolf Reed will look at the state of the American left. And at the bottom of the hour, Sungur Savran will analyze Turkish politics in the light of the defeat of the ruling AKP party in the recent parliamentary elections. First, Adolf Reed. Adolf frequently appears in Behind the News to lament the state of the American left. He and I had been privately discussing its sad situation in the wake of the Left Forum, the annual conference held in New York that attracts many luminaries of the U.S. and global progressive community, as some might call it. He teaches political science at the University of Pennsylvania. Adolf Reed.
Hey, Adolf, you skipped the Left Forum this year, huh?
Yeah, I did. I had a conflict. That's a polite way to view it.
You were doing Planet Earth, in other words.
Well, no, actually, I was supposed to go down to a panel at the Labor and Working Class History Association conference on that Saturday, but as it turned out, I wound up not doing that either.
All right, so you were a distant observer on some of the proceedings, right? What's your diagnosis of the state of the left's being?
On the personal tip, I'd say my diagnosis is I really dodged a bullet. Because the panel that I was supposed to have been on was kind of crazy. And I saw that one. I saw a video of that panel as well as the closing plenary. And I got to say, Doug, I was just blown away. I mean, I referred in an email to somebody to what I called the Bay of Pigs approach to movement building, by which I mean, you know, the objective that the CIA had for the Bay of Pigs invasion in 1961 was that the counterinsurgents or the invading force of right-wing Cubans would just get far enough off the beach to be able to establish themselves off the beach so that the U.S. would recognize them as the provisional government and then send in the 82nd Airborne, as they did 4 years later in the Dominican Republic. But it didn't work out because the Cuban military and the volunteer militia kept them from getting off the beach. And what's occurred to me is that in the wake of Ferguson, et cetera, we've seen something like that. In fact, we've seen that for a good while, and what we might look at as social movement creation via press announcement. But post-Ferguson, it seems to have the technological advances with the Internet and the like seem to have accelerated the process so the episodic demonstrations become a pretext for projection of a number of articulate, more or less articulate voices of color and their non of color pals, allies, running dogs or whatever, as conduits to the anonymous leadership of what are touted as spontaneous movements that are spreading. And then those individuals then become voices, as we saw on the panel that I was to have been on at the Left Forum initially, voices who called for, who insist that the task of building a viable left in the United States hinges most crucially on accepting and respecting black leadership, which just had me kind of scratching my head because what black leadership according to whom, and what does respecting black leadership mean, and can you really be claiming that just because you've got the microphone now that means you're somebody who should be paid attention to, or if it's not you, then who is it, or I mean, what's the story? And I mean, this kind of struck me, among other reasons, because it brought to mind like a couple of earlier versions of this. I recall Jesse Jackson's two campaigns for the Democratic presidential nomination, the first especially, which I wrote about, there was a trope in the campaign that, okay, well, so Jackson goes to talk to a church or a lot of people in a church, and then the next thing you know, because there were a lot of people who were enthusiastic in the church, then comes the claim that this is a resurgent movement and that Jackson is the leader of this resurgent movement and that he therefore must be respected. Because the movement must be respected, black people must be respected, et cetera, et cetera. But even earlier, you're going back to the 70s, at the dawn of what would be before long the new communist moment, there was a similar line among black power radicals who wanted to kind of split the difference between a Marxist and a nationalist take on things. that because the white working class was so fundamentally racist, black workers had to take the lead in building the revolutionary movement. And one would ask, because I was in this position of asking a few times, well, but if white workers are irredeemably racist, then how is it that black workers are going to be able to take the lead in the first place?
Who will be the followers of these leaders?
Well, yeah, exactly. And the responses that I get sort of trailed off into quotes from Cabral and Nkrumah and Fanon and whatever. At what point does naivete become self-righteous foolishness or careerist aspiration? I mean, who knows? But whatever it is, it doesn't seem healthy politically.
Who nominates these leaders, one always wants to wonder. In the case of Jesse Jackson, I believe God initially nominated him, or he had a conversation with God who told him to run.
That's exactly correct. Right. I mean, that's exactly correct.
But at least Jackson ran in primaries and got votes.
Right.
Now it's what is your population of Twitter followers seems to be your mode of anointment.
I guess that's right. I mean, since I haven't since I've still resisted the urge to sign up for Twitter, I don't know, but that seems to be the case. And I have considered for a while that the blogosphere, as I think I've said on your show before, which one must recall is open to any fool with a computer and internet access, but there's a strain within the blogosphere that seems to be driven by a marketing imperative that one hopes would lead either to CNN or, I guess, more likely now to MSNBC if you consider yourself left of center. And it seems like this Twitter follower thing is like another elaboration of the same ontology, or is it epistemology, or both? And I guess it doesn't matter whether it's disingenuous or ingenuous, because it all comes out to the same thing. But again, I just come back to this. It just seems like another expression of the desperation of the times that we're in, and the extent to which so much of what understands itself to be the progressive or the left world continues to think through the boss's eyes, basically.
One of the officially nominated leaders to come out of Ferguson is a Teach for America guy who is the head of human capital for the Minneapolis public school system. He was nominated as one of the official leaders by no less than the New York Times Magazine a few weeks ago.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
To whom are these people answerable? What is their agenda? How do they get in this position? Who nominates? Is it just elites that nominate these people, essentially?
Well, I mean, that's my sense, Doug. I don't know. I mean, I saw an interview with DeRay McKesson, who's the one you're talking about, who is articulate enough, certainly, and he did a nice thing with backing down Wolf Blitzer from a hoary trope that Blitzer was trying to append to I think, the Baltimore events. But I think it wasn't the Blitzer one. I think it was another interview I saw with him, maybe on MSNBC, where he said that he quit his job with the Minneapolis public school system to be an activist full time. And, I mean, not to be a jerk about this, or even to be like a COINTELPRO veteran, but my first thought was, oh, well, how are you reproducing the terms of your daily existence if you quit your job to do this full time? Because I haven't seen that anybody in Ferguson, much less in Baltimore, has money to pay a full-time bullhorn carrier, and especially to go from one city to another. So I'm just kind of curious, but I have no idea. I mean,
well, I would think that a guy with a Teach for America pedigree, I went to Bowdoin College, is pretty good at working the nonprofit circuit.
I would assume that's correct. And that's the other thing that kind of struck me about, that lineup on those two panels that I watched at the Left Forum, the foundation connections, right, the nonprofit connections are, kind of striking. Right. And I mean, this has been their story from the very beginning. This has been their story from the, depending on when you want to, start the meter of history running, from the 50s and 60s, where they were concerned about a latter day version of race adjustment, to the 20s and 30s, when they were concerned about an earlier version of race adjustment, or maybe earlier versions of what was then called openly a racial adjustment that had to do with ways of managing what might look to someone else like class problems in cities, not least by squeezing them into a primordialist discourse of ancient group or natural group tensions. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, I am quite curious about this, although I do recall, I think you and I talked about this at the time. In fact, you probably brought it to my attention that that the TFA elements in St. Louis or in Missouri were in Ferguson, I believe, as early as last summer.
Well, I think Arne Duncan convened a group to, if Arne Duncan is going to Ferguson, you know he wants to charterize their schools.
Yeah, I mean, like, unless there's a Sandlot basketball game he wants to play in, but because those are the only two reasons that he does anything. But yeah, no, I think that's right. And I mean, didn't you have an exchange with New McKesson about that when he was basically non-responsive to the query about TFA?
Yeah, I gave him a hard time about consorting with Arne Duncan in the wake of yet another episode of horrendous police violence. And he said, I'm just a protester, batting his eyes innocently when you got elite foundations moving in, elite formations like TFA, and, of course, the Obama administration moving in to take over what is going to present itself as a popular movement.
But, and see, that's something that's made me wonder a bit more, too, about the upshot of this wave of concern with police violence and with what appears to be racialized police violence as well. I mean, because in the first place, it's not anything new, really. And people who know anything about this, either, you know, from studying it or from Walking While Black or whatever.
I'm speaking with Adolph Reed, professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania. Now, you grew up in New Orleans. You're not unused to racist police departments.
Hardly. I mean, like, I've said in public that when I, the first time I saw the Battle of Algiers, I thought, oh my God, I know this movie. I was in this movie. And then my son had it, like, in New Haven, too. But, I mean, in the mid-80s. But, well, I mean, there are a couple of things that I think people need to think a little more carefully about. But both of which have something to do with, you know, fun things you can do with numbers, right? Like, while it's no doubt true that an identifiably, solidly middle-class black or Latino person is more likely to be jacked up by the police than a similarly situated white person, I doubt very seriously that it's the case that, or that's not the case, I guess is the way to put this, that identifiably middle-class black or Latino person would be much less likely to be jacked up by the police than a working-class or impoverished black or Latino person. Or to put it another way, that I suspect that the ways that race and locale signify each other is an important part of the mix, right? Stress policing is I suspect much more likely to be applied across the board in areas that have been carved out in the framework of neoliberal policing, basically, as areas to be contained with high stress tactics, right? And in some parts of the country, you know, there will be those areas will be, you know, predominantly white, right? And I mean, obviously, my point isn't to deny the existence of a striking racial disparity, but my concern is that it's two things. One is that the simplistic blacks are much more likely to be victimized by the police than whites story is more complicated than that, and more complicated than that in ways that have to do with class across race, frankly.
Well, they're very mixed up in America.
Yeah, totally. Well, but they're not entirely indistinguishable, right?
And,
right. So, I mean, I remember, like, when Butch, in the early 90s, I think, Butch Graves, former Yale basketball star whose father was a publisher of Black Enterprise, magazine, was jacked up by the cops when he was trying to get on the Metro North train from Grand Central. And this was a horror, but it was a horror because it was Butch Graves, right? Or when Skip Gates got arrested in his home. And I mean, the narrative that forms around these cases like this is that the outrage is such that it shows that this could happen to any random black person. Well, the fact of the matter is that, Butch Graves and Skip Gates are also likely to be the statistical outliers among the black people to whom it could happen, right? But my point isn't just kind of a snotty academic one, but it makes me wonder how the issue is defined in public discussion it makes me wonder about what the ultimate political ramifications of this issue are going to be, what the responses are going to be. And, you know, I mean, yeah, it's attack conspiratorial, but it makes me wonder what ideological work heightened public attention to this issue is actually performing or is likely to perform. And I'm not, I don't mean to suggest that, you know, there's a deep conspiratorial department in the bourgeoisie that makes stuff like this up. I mean, they just aren't that smart. I mean, you know, you went to school with them. I taught them. But it is the case that, you know, there are sort of deep thinking elements of the bipartisan neoliberal governing class who are prepared to work overtime, as it were, to produce socially acceptable definitions of the nature of these problems, to produce responses that are system maintaining, shall we say, like instead of systems challenging.
Yeah, which actually makes for a bit of a little diagonal in the discourse here, but I think it's related, is we're seeing the mobilization of the nation and the salon liberals.
Right.
To go after Bernie Sanders, who, you know, I'm not the biggest Bernie Sanders fan in the world, but he is bringing up some kinds of issues that I think both of us find important.
Yeah.
And they're going after him precisely for not embracing the Black Lives Matter movement. They're going after him. We had Stephen Gillers in The Nation yesterday going on about how criticisms of Hillary Clinton are just anxieties about powerful women. So we're seeing these tropes used.
Wow.
To defend, you know, this politician who is at the heart of American power and has been for decades.
Right.
And somehow Sanders is the reactionary in this model.
It's really striking, Doug. And look, like you, I mean, I'll say this again to Michelle Goldberg. I don't support third-party candidacies as a way to build a movement or much less as a way to win anything. That said, I've given Bernie some money. I'm going to give Bernie some more money probably for as long as he sticks around, because I think it is important that somebody's pushing these issues and not just into the ether. I mean, I think there's a possibility. It's not a great one by any means, but there's a possibility that some trade union interests and others might condense around this movement or this motion around the candidacy and start a strategic discussion or undertake a strategic discussion of the kind that I've been arguing for some time we need to have that will extend beyond however long Bernie's in the race. So in that sense, he could be like a rabbit in a 5,000-meter race. But, you know, that said, I've been kind of taken aback by some of this stuff, the de facto race baiting of him. Joan Walsh, I mean, she's – I can still recall her reaction to my Harper's article a couple of years ago, where she points out that apparently I had somehow not noticed the radical left transformation of the Democratic Party that occurred since 2011. So I thought, okay, so enough said. I was a little more surprised at Katha Pilot, although Katha, as you know, has had tendencies for this kind of exuberance, right? I mean, she was all pumped about the Year of the Woman. In the Senate in 1992, I think it was, when Patty Murray and Barbara Mikulski and Carol Moseley Braun got elected to the Senate. To her credit, by the time welfare reform came around a few years later, she backed away from that one. But, Doug, I tell you, man, I mean, I was struck. You know, around the 2008 election, I was an officer in the AAUP, and I spent a lot of time with, you know, among my boomer feminist colleagues, and was really kind of surprised at how much the support of Clinton, and, you know, this is even like before or just after the Clinton-Obama thing got resolved, but how much support for Clinton came from that demographic, at least, on explicitly identitarian grounds. I mean, people would say, well, you know, I'm backing her because she's a woman and that's my identity. So I thought, wow. And granted, you know, that's what blacks and others were doing with Obama, too, right? But it just says something about the overall debasement of the politics. I mean, I think you know that I don't see Clinton as particularly disgusting or demonizable any more than the other Dems. So I've never been like a Hillary basher, like in that sense. But the way this thing is going to play out is like it always plays out, no matter what Bernie does. I mean, we're going to wind up being called on to vote for her as the lesser evil because the Republican will be much more dangerous. And this time that might be right, even though she's dangerous enough. So it's going to be the same story that we've had to deal with ever since, you know, probably 1988, right, since the birth of the DLC. But it is. I mean, I'm with you. I'm just kind of stunned at this, both at the kind of crudely gender-based defensiveness about Clinton, but even more that the way to or the sense that the way to protect her is to attack Sanders on race grounds, as if his pursuit of or his calls for economic redistribution wouldn't have much greater impact on many more black people than, you know, any of the respected racial voices that Right on Alternate would call for.
Well, I can't imagine what, say, reforms of the policing systems in the U.S. would have more of an effect on the lives of black Americans than the kind of redistribution that Sanders is talking about.
Right. Yeah, I know. Well, and see, to me, that just says, you know, that just speaks eloquently of the class cocoon within which all of this conversation occurs, right? I mean, The Nation, MSNBC, you know, New Republic, a lot of the American Prospect, although they tend to be a little better than others. And I mean, all of that crap that comes from, like, the internet fundraising left, as I sometimes call it. And, I mean, the black studies-based blogosphere. I mean, it's it seems to me that that's tantamount to a confession of a class politics.
Yeah, well, it's amazing how much of these people, you know, the magazines you listed or the institutions or the websites, they're full of Ivy League graduates and the like.
Yes, they are. And faculty. But yeah, and I mean, that's the constituency, right?
So in the 5 minutes we have remaining.
Okay.
What is to be done, comrade?
Oh, man, I don't know. I mean, I've hit the point of life now. It's my son's 45th birthday, as I mentioned earlier, where I just, you know, every now and then I'll just put on Mahalia Jackson and sing Soon I Will Be Done with the Troubles of the World. But I think the thing to be done is the thing, you know, the same thing as always to have been done. And it's like to, you know, I mean, to start out from an understanding of inequality in America and injustice in America that's rooted in political economy. And I think it's becoming clearer, or it should be becoming clearer, that the deep fault line trench, you know, within the nominal left in the U.S. is between those who presume that the metric of injustice and inequality has to do, I mean, directly with, or the root, I guess I should say, has to do with the normal functioning of the dynamics of American capitalism, and those who oppose any views like that.
That was Adolph Reed, professor of political science at Penn. The writing about Jesse Jackson that he mentioned is the Jesse Jackson Phenomenon, The Crisis of Purpose in Afro-American Politics, published in 1986 by Yale University Press. You'll listen to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood in the program Behind the News. Back after a musical break. It was some of Bastards in Blue, a golden oldie from 1983, by the Partisans. Next, Sungur Sovereign, an Istanbul-based political economist who is the editor of Red Med, as in Mediterranean, a political website you can find at redmed.org. Turkey's ruling party, the AKP, headed by President Recep Erdogan, excuse my butchering of the Turkish language, suffered a major defeat in the June 7 parliamentary elections. Here's Sungur Sovereign to tell us what it all means.
Welcome. So you had an election recently, and the ruling party was
apparently defeated, but things are more ambiguous than that. Just give us the summary of what the election returns to start with.
Well, I think this is not only a defeat, but even a debacle for the AKP, the ruling party. They have been in power for 12 years, and in each election, they won a very high ratio of the popular vote, starting from 33% in 2002, going up to 45% in 2007, and all the way to 49.5%, almost 50% in 2011. So the fact that they have now fallen to 40% is significant in itself. Plus, there is the fact that they have not received a majority of the seats in Parliament. That is very, very important. Let me explain why this is, qualitatively speaking, a defeat for the leader of the party and former Prime Minister, now President of the Republic, Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Erdogan started out this campaign by asking the population to give him, that is to say the AKP, although he's supposed to be neutral from the constitutional point of view between parties, he asked the population for 400 seats in a parliament where the total number of seats is 550. Then he had to lower this to 330, which is another kind of constitutional level for changing the constitution. His whole point was that he wanted an executive presidency for himself, so that he could rule Turkey single-handedly and in a very despotic manner, as he has been doing for the last several years.
Now, he was term limited out of serving as prime minister, right, and then ran for president?
No, not really. He was prime minister for 12 years. He was never brought down. He chose to become the president of the republic in the first presidential elections that were held on the basis of a popular vote, which was only last year, August 2014. But that is a ceremonial post, as you find in many parliamentary systems all around Europe. Therefore, this was, you know, too narrow for him. He wanted to rule Turkey single-handedly and asked the population to give him a sufficient majority to change the constitution so that he could establish a presidential system, mind you, not of the American style, but of the Putin style, definitely. And therefore, the fact that they have not even received a simple majority of 276 when he had made the starting bid from 400 is a definite rejection of the man's long-term project by the population. It is a defeat of a very strategic kind, I find, personally. But let me add immediately, before we turn to other parties, you probably have other questions as well, let me turn immediately to something you may want to deepen. If you wish to deepen this, I would like to go on with this. I think the defeat had come much earlier, 2 years ago, during the popular revolt that started with the Gezi events. Most of the audience will probably remember this. This was a part of the international scene of popular revolts all around the world, from Egypt to Brazil, and Turkey joined the fray in June 2013 when millions of people came out on the streets for a full month in June, but the whole thing continued up until September. I think the Prime Minister of that time had already received a very heavy blow, and I think these elections are the first political registration, so to speak, the first stamp put on that defeat.
Those demonstrations were inspired. He wanted to turn, what was it, a public area or a park into a shopping mall?
Well, that's why they started. But we have spoken about this with you, and I think that one should refrain from narrowing it down to that. Yes, it started with the protests against the demolition of a park in the very center of Istanbul, Taksim Square, with the purpose of building a shopping mall instead. However, it's immediately spread like wildfire to the rest of Turkey and included all kinds of social strata. One of the most important, this is important for the U.S. audience, being the Alevis. The Alevis are the minority religious denomination in Turkey as opposed to the majority Sunnis, and they are of the same denomination as the Syrian regime. Although the Syrian regime is really not a denominational kind of regime, but nonetheless, this is how it is characterized by Erdogan. So, Erdogan has been attacking the Syrian regime on the pretext that it is an Alevi regime, and attacking the Alevis as well. The Alevis, which is a very sizable minority in Turkey, some range it from 10 to 20 million out of a population, total population of 75 million, they were the most important, perhaps, element of this popular uprising. So it is a complex kind of situation which I would call an intra-class movement of very important popular content.
Erdogan's regime, he was, as you pointed out, getting increasingly authoritarian and Putin-esque, right? Who is he governing in the interests of? What is his popular base?
Well, I would call this government an anti-worker, pro-capitalist government of the purest type. The U.S. audience may remember that there was a previous fundamentalist Islamist government in Turkey under the historic leader Erbakan, who was later brought down by a military intervention. From the ashes of that movement came this movement, the AKP, the Justice and Development Party of Erdogan, who adopted neoliberalism of the purest kind and acted as pro-Western interests, and in particular pro-European Union, which had been refused by the historic leader all the time. So he started carrying out what is called in economic parlance structural reforms of different kinds, privatizations to start with, but also subcontracting in the workplace, flexibility, and all the different paraphernalia that is the toolbox of the bourgeoisie nowadays internationally. And he caused the workers to suffer under very severe conditions, for instance, of occupational safety and health. Listeners may remember the incident in the mines of Soma in May 2014, exactly a year ago, when 301 miners lost their lives in a supposedly work-related accident, which really, in fact, was a massacre because the whole thing had been prepared by all the practice that had gone before under this government. Also, strikes were constantly banned by this government in the name of national security. The laws made by the military government of the early 1980s permits this, so the government used it, these powers, to the very end. That's why I would say this government really serves the bourgeoisie. But
within that bourgeoisie, is there a split between a domestically oriented one and an internationally oriented one, or do they pretty much see eye to eye?
And I wouldn't call it that, put it that way. I would put it in a different way. It is true, I agree with you, that the bourgeoisie is divided into two different wings. One, the traditional ruling one, which is very westernizing, very pro-NATO and pro-EU and everything. And, for instance, its major representative, the Koch family, are partners of Fiat and Ford and all the multinationals that one can think of. The same is true for all the others, who are really targeted by Erdogan because he is really the organic representative of the newly rising, what you call perhaps the domestically oriented bourgeoisie, which is of an Islamist orientation, but they also are internationally oriented, but this time to the Islamic world, I would say. To the Middle East, first and foremost, starting with the Gulf countries, because there's so much money there, and oil and everything. But then also as markets, the whole Middle East, Southern African region of Arabic countries, Islamic countries, the Central Asia, of course, etc., etc., and many countries of Africa. So this is a new kind of international orientation as well on the part of that bourgeoisie, which is itself kind of monopoly capital by now. It is not, you know, this old provincial small or medium scale capital that it used to be, where that used to be the basis of the Islamic movement in Turkey. It is now itself organized in big holding companies with banks of its own, which although these banks function according to the rules of the Sharia, that is to say, no interest banking.
How serious is he and his party about their Islamism?
This is, you know, very debatable. He constantly keeps flirting with the West as well, but at times enters into conflict with the different strands, policies of the United States or the European Union, and at times with Israel. But his main aim, though, I think, strategic aim, and this is serious, I think, is to expand Turkey's influence economically and politically all over the Middle East, as by acting as the ram's head, so to speak, of the Sunni coalition that has been emerging between Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Turkey, as opposed to the Shia Alevi wing of Islam, which is, of course, most forcefully represented by the Iranian regime.
I'm speaking with the Turkish political economist Sungur Savran. Now, I would imagine that Washington finds that useful.
Well, to a certain extent, Doug, because let me put this very clearly. At times, because of the, for instance, rapprochement between the United States and Iran on the question of nuclear weapons, but also, I, by the way, interpret that rapprochement as also opening up the Iranian regime to global capitalism, and there are many signs of this, and therefore that kind of rapprochement, of course, is not to the liking of Saudi Arabia and Erdogan at all. And therefore, there is a kind of distance now opening up, a kind of rift opening up between Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Turkey on the one hand, and the United States on the other, which is trying to play, I think, to a certain extent, the role of arbiter between the Sunnis and the Shia in the Middle East. However, and this, of course, becomes very clear when America uses air bombardments to tame, at least, if not to destroy the so-called Islamic State with its caliph and all that, while Turkey is still, I think, underhandedly, and this is what Obama said only 2 days ago, supporting the ISIL, that is to say, the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. So there is a rift, I think, there.
And the neoliberal reforms that he instituted, did that engineer any kind of economic boom? What's the state of the Turkish economy?
Erdogan has been praised lavishly by Western finance capital for having brought Turkey a long period of growth and having made Turkey the 17th biggest economy of the world, etc., etc. This is because the conjuncture was very, very much in favor of this kind of country. Remember the whole rhetoric about the BRICS during the 2000s. After the so-called Great Recession, which I would call a Great Depression, but never mind that debate, of 2008, which started in 2008, let's put it, which has lasted for the last 7 years, what happened in Turkey was, at first, because interest rates were so low in the advanced countries, capital moved out, as we all know, to countries like Turkey and Brazil and China. And so Turkey really had a very high rate of growth after that, too. It was not really impacted by the Great Recession. It is now, only now, seeing the impact of recession, and especially what is happening in Europe, because Turkey's economy is very much integrated with that of Europe. I think Erdogan, this defeat of Erdogan is very much, very important in determining the outcome of the future of the Middle East, not in the economic sense, because I think any one of the bourgeois parties that may replace Erdogan in the future, or the AKP, and push, and Erdogan is the president for until 2019, unless he is tried for all his corruption, for which there is ample evidence. But if he remains in power as a ceremonial president, and other bourgeois parties take power, and there are two contenders. One is the founder of the Republic, the Republican People's Party, that's to say the CHP, which is also a member of the misnamed Socialist International, and the other one is a party of fascist origin, but is trying to look softer these days and may join hands with the CHP, that's the MHP. These two parties, with some support from other quarters, may form a coalition government. They will certainly follow the same neoliberal policies as Erdogan and the AKP had been following before, perhaps not as forcefully as before. The real impact will be, first, on the question of democratic rights in Turkey. This will be a real transformation of the situation in Turkey because, you know, we were going towards a kind of tyranny under Erdogan. Now that he is losing ground, things are looking much brighter. And secondly, I think in the Middle East, the ISIL will probably lose its most important supporter. Because remember, Turkey has a land frontier with Syria of 900 kilometers. That makes something like 600 miles. That is, you know, kind of like a Swiss, like, you know, a piece of Swiss cheese where ISIL the militants can spend the night in Turkey and then make raids into Syria, etc., etc. All kinds of assistance, arms, healthcare, etc., etc. So I think ISIL will lose a lot. The Islamic State may grow weaker in the process.
A Kurdish party won seats in parliament for the first time, right?
They had been in parliament having had their candidates elected on independent slates. Because of this hideous 10% threshold in Turkish electoral law, a constitutional provision, by the way, that was established by the military government again of the early 80s, which meant that unless a party crossed that 10% threshold at the level of the country, it could not send any representatives to parliament. Therefore, they always competed on an independent slate. This time, they took a chance, and they won handsomely. You know, this was a victory that could be called a mini landslide because they had started out from a base which everyone considered was around 6% or 7% only 4 years ago. Only in the presidential elections of August 2014, their candidate, who is also their leader, Selahattin Demirtas, who was a very successful figure, politically speaking, received 9.8%, which was very close to the threshold, obviously. So they gained courage from that and ran as a party. They got 13%, which surprised everyone, and became the third party in parliament, in fact, surpassing the fascists by one seat, 81 seats in a parliament of 550, which is, you know, an immense victory for them and for also the left, because this new party, the HDP, which is the People's Democracy Party, is a combination of the Kurdish movement, and of course they have the hegemony because they're so powerful, with some Turkish socialist parties. And parties which were outside of that party, socialist parties, also, some parties, also called for a vote to this new party. This is the reason why Erdogan really was defeated, because once they passed the 10% threshold, that meant that that reduced the seats of the AKP by, 81, of course, if one is speaking mathematically. Had they remained at 9.9%, the AKP, because it's so strong in the Kurdish regions of the country, would have received probably 70 more seats. So this is the major reason why the AKP was defeated. Now, this gives great power to the Kurdish liberation movement. That's one. Secondly, this, one should note, is a result of two popular revolts that Turkey had with within the space of 1 year. After the Gezi revolt came to an end in September 2013, only 1 year after that, the Kurds rose up in defense of Kobani, the canton of Rojava, Syria, the Syrian part of Kurdistan, under attack from the ISIL, the Islamic State, for 1 week in their millions, and would not go back until Öcalan, their leader in prison, called them back and into their homes. So that makes two popular revolts within the space of 1 year, which fed into this victory in very concrete terms. One, because Erdogan was defending ISIL at that time, the Kurds that supported Erdogan also turned their faces to this movement, the HDP. Secondly, during the Gezi revolt, and this is something, you know, striking, all these Turks, white-collar, educated, working-class people, white-collar, petty bourgeois, highly educated, doctors and engineers, professional liberal professions, etc., etc. All these people said, this is when we learn how the Turkish state was oppressive vis-à-vis the Kurds. So they, for the first time, adopted the Kurdish movement as a legitimate movement. That's why they voted in their hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions, this time for this movement. That is why also, for instance, in cities like Istanbul and Izmir, which are very pro-CHP, the so-called Social Democratic Party, because of the Kemalism and the republicanism of these strata, voted higher than 10% for the HDP.
We're just about out of time, but what kind of government can emerge from these election results? It doesn't seem very coherent.
No, this is very difficult. This is very difficult to foresee. But may I, very briefly point out that there is now a third movement which will really probably stamp the whole situation in the coming future, in the near future, and that is a wildcat strike by the metal workers in their tens of thousands, which has lasted now for almost a month, and which has wrested victory from the bosses, and now, which is a movement that was first a revolt against a yellow gangster union, and these workers are now joining a more progressive union. So this is the working class proper coming into the political scene in Turkey probably in the next few years, which will really mean a lot to the rise of the left, which has already seen a whipped kind of victory from that of the HDP. Now, with respect to the government, Erdogan's main effort is not to let a government be formed without the presence of the AKP, because that would mean that he and his ministers would be taken before justice. That's very important for him. The whole period of the last 2 years have passed, and Erdogan was so despotic because he was trying to defend himself from being brought to justice, and his ministers as well. So that is very important. That's one decisive factor. And Erdogan is still a powerful figure because, after all, as you were saying at the beginning of this interview, the AKP is by far the first party, still the front runner. Secondly, his main, and this is the last thing I'm going to say, his main opponent today is Abdullah Gül, the former president of the republic, who comes from the same tradition, belongs to the same party. Abdullah Gül is playing for the position of chairman of the AKP, and because the AKP probably will now go through an earthquake, he has a great possibility of taking that position, which means he will, of course, become prime minister and Erdogan will be pushed to the back. Abdullah Gül has a much more pro-US, pro-Western kind of politics than Erdogan, who has this strategic vision for the Middle East and the Islamic world. And Abdullah Gül is much more open to a kind of compromise with other parties and much less despotic in his manner of ruling. So that is, I think, our listeners should set their eyes on the struggle between these two men. Although at this point, because Abdullah Gül is playing so secretively and astutely his whole game, this is not in the headlines very often.
That was Sungur Savran, an Istanbul-based political economist who is the editor of the political website RedMed, redmed.org. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of the finale of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, the portion where the famous Ode to Joy, an unofficial anthem of the European Union, whose celebration of peace and human solidarity is weirdly interrupted by a Turkish military march, a genre popular in Europe at the time, with lyrics evoking a hero's march to war. It's performed by the Berlin Philharmonic under Herbert von Karajan. Till next week, bye.